you were reunited with Ritchie Blackmore in New York.
When he stepped on the stage, you know, that magic moment. It's been a long time. Deep Purple were looking for a new singer and bass player after their first three records. Roger came along with me, and we joined not just as a singer and a bass player, but as a nascent songwriting team. One guy says, well, how do you write your song? I'm thinking, oh my God, how are we going to answer that? Richie, he's rehearsing on his guitar. He just goes on an open string, ding, 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 ding. He said, like that. We wrote it on the bus and we did it in the show that night.
Wow. What about Smoke on the Water?
It kind of got forgotten because it was 7 minutes long. It never got played on the radio. And a guy called Rush Shaw from Warner Brothers cut it down to 3 minutes 20. It became the most played rock song ever in history on the radio. You're watching Joanne Butler in the studio with me, Ian Gillan from Deep Purple.
Thank you so much for joining us on Life Minute. So cool to have you. Happy birthday. You just celebrated 81. Hard to believe. You look amazing.
Well, thank you. So do you. Happy birthday.
Thank you. So how's the tour going?
It's probably the best we've ever done. It's working out really good. The show is lovely. The band is cranking and I can't complain. It's a long one. We start at the beginning of June and we finish on the 19th of December in Mexico. Where it's pretty intense. I would say insane rather than intense. it's wonderful.
Insanely intense. Both of those words. That's amazing. How do you do it after all these decades? What still makes you able to get on that stage and do it?
Well, you don't really need any motivation when you're lucky enough, as I am, to be in a great company, great band, great musicians, a great repertoire, and great audiences. All the elements are there for anything you could dream of, really.
Yeah.
So just get up and be happy, you know. And I think if there wasn't the energy, it would be pretty much a drudge going through this routine every single day. But there's always something new happening in the show. And of course, for different venue every night, that gives you a different kind of ambience. And it's just too exciting for words. Yeah.
Amazing. And of course, you were reunited just last week, was it, with Ritchie Blackmore in New York? Tell us about that. I think that was a big surprise for so many.
I think it was lovely. It was fantastic. We've been in touch, Richie and I, for a few years now. And a lot of water's gone under the bridge. I don't like using cliches, but that's a very apt one for this. And he wrote me a nice letter a few days before we got to New York and said, would it be all right, do you think? What do you reckon if I step up in Smoke? So I said, yeah, of course. Oh, you brought an instant smile to my face. I thought, well, of course, it would be wonderful. It'd be fantastic. So we set up, and he only lives around the corner from Jones Beach, so on Long Island. So it was just great when he stepped on the stage, you know, that magic moment. And it's been a long time. And, you know, you kind of forget everyone out there when we've mended all of those problems ourselves. But of course, not everyone is aware of that. So it was a wonderfully warm feeling. And we had a few drinks in the dressing room backstage afterwards. And I think he went home a bit tiddly, but it was great. Really a magic moment. Yeah.
Beautiful. He said recently to someone that it was like, he thought it would be like a healing, but he realized there really was none after 40 years. Did you feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, life goes through so many different phases, and you can't really allow all these problems to continue to exist. They become destructive forces in their own right. Then we've grown out of all that. Did you ever see Spinal Tap?
Yes.
Well, it was like that for most of us, including the Beatles and everyone else. You know, there was, when you get four or five guys, you know, in their late teens or early 20s, form a band and go out on the road, there's a camaraderie and a unit there that is almost makes them inseparable, and it gives them a great power and identity. But as things become enlarged, you know, you get into contact with the real world and a larger world. A lot of outside play comes into force. And, you know, human chemistry is the most complex of all the sciences. So we can't cater for it. We can't see it coming because we're young, and then you've got to cope with stuff that you never did before, and it's critical.
Yeah.
So sometimes things go wrong, but that doesn't mean to say they have to stay that way. So as the years go by, you put it all behind you.
Plus such creative forces, you know. on top of it all. Tell us about Splat, the new album. How would you describe it?
Well, I'm always looking for an umbrella, kind of as I describe it, for the lyrics. I like all the songs on an album to feel as if they were written around about the same time and they come from the same place. And in this case, I was thinking of quite a few things that came together, and I conflated them into an idea of the critical extinction moment of humanity based on the population explosion and our inability to sustain life as it is. And it was just a thought. And so I had this picture of God and Darwin in the pub, down the pub, having a pint of beer. And God says to Darwin, Charlie, we got to get the numbers right next time. And Darwin goes humby, humby, hum, because he doesn't like to interfere, you know. And then I thought of butterflies and metamorphosis, and I thought of humanity morphing into a metaphysical state, an abstract life form, electrical life form, where we wouldn't need little tin cans to go around and explore the galaxies, but we could actually blink of an eye be there. And it's quite complex, but it
Yes.
gave me the possibility that there was something hopeful after the end. And I'd had Splat in my mind as a title for some years, but it always seemed so terminal. I know everyone would be saying, oh, so this is the last album, right? But now we've managed to get something which has hope out of existential moments. And I think it's almost incredible. I mean, there's a song in there about a dead man walking, and it's really hopeful. It's a good message. I mean, just for me, it keeps me happy and out of trouble. That's the kind of idea. That's what Splat meant. You know, when the old joke about when the insect hits the windscreen, what's the last thing that goes through his mind? Well, we all know that one. But when I hit the windscreen, the first thing that went through my mind was King Arthur, followed by Motorhead, followed by the Roman Empire, and every other element of humanity that's existed. And they all go out into space in chess as chess pieces, and then we sort of all pixelate and collect together in some metaphysical form and start a new existence.
I love it. Deep for sure. How about the sound? How would you describe the sound?
The lineup hasn't really changed instrumentally. John Lord died, obviously, and Richie left, and we had Steve Morse for 25 years, and recently we got Simon McBride in the band, and I think his style and background are perhaps more compatible with the early Deep Purple. Steve was brilliant, but his roots are in Southern American rock and jazz and stuff like that, which took us in a new direction, which we all loved for 25 years, so it couldn't have been bad.
Yes.
But Simon's brought us back on to, I think, a more grounded approach. I think the easiest way of describing this is the new songs fit very well with the old songs.
Yes.
They're very compatible, and so they work very well live on stage. It's kind of seamless. Sound-wise, on the record, we owe that to Bob Ezrin, our producer, who's for the last five, six, God knows how many records, has done a great job in not only tightening up our arrangements, but also getting us a great sound. And that's really, I think, a difficult job to achieve for an old
Yes.
band like us. There are no leader in our band, there never has been. So we sit around for weeks, you know, debating this issue or that regarding an arrangement. Should we keep this phrase in or extend that, or should we let loose here? And Bob goes, I'm not liking it. And so we chop it and keep it sharp. And I think the arrangements have sharpened up a lot. And the sound he's got is perhaps more representative than what you might call the intervening years.
What is the creative process like, and how has it evolved over the years?
It hasn't really changed. It's just tightened up a lot. We have two writing sessions, normally a week each, and we go to our place in Germany. They've got a big room there where we store our equipment in a small town near Oberhausen. So we spend a week there. We start at noon every day and we finish at 6, and we stop at 3 o'clock for a cup of tea. And they just start cranking, and it's pure jamming. And if you're a fly on the wall, you might be hearing some film music or some jazz or some mood music or funk, soul, blues, rhythm and blues, rock and roll. And anything that comes to mind, everyone else picks up on it. And at the end of the first week, we normally have about 25 ideas. And we then do another session a few weeks later and come up with another 15, 20 ideas. Then we've got to chop those down to 15, which are the most promising for the what you might call a melody. And I'm singing gibberish at this point, just making up words that fit and rhyme and meter and that sort of thing. So then we move into the arrangement phase. We could normally go to Nashville for that, and spend a couple of weeks tightening things up. That's when Bob comes into the picture. And then we go straight from there into a wonderful studio, a big, big studio, one of the few remaining. By then, we've learned all the songs. We haven't got all the words, but we've got all the arrangements absolutely nailed. And most of the tunes from the vocal point of view. And we've rehearsed them pretty well. So the guys sit around in a circle and record everything live. The whole album is recorded live, with a few exceptions, some cleanup bits and some tweaks and that sort of thing. But basically, it's a live recording. And I think that captures the moment and the edge.
Yes.
If you start overlaying tracks, then it becomes a bit dulled. In impact, I think it takes the sharpness away. So yeah, live then, and then it's over to me to finish off the words and do the vocals and add them afterwards. And that's pretty much as it's been since day one in 1969.
Wow.
Except we used to take months and months writing and recording. We don't now.
Really? It took longer back then.
Back then it did because we were having too much fun.
Right. And maybe not so much fun.
No, I was just saying we're having too much fun. Basically, we weren't sharp enough, and we weren't touring as much in those days. I know we did a lot of shows, but they were in small patches and that sort of thing. But now we're on the road a lot longer, and
Makes
but the
sense.
whole thing actually takes about a year, from beginning to the end of post-production.
I always found it interesting that you guys, no one ever took the credit. Like you said, it was always equal, which is nice. So, what did you guys argue about creatively? What were the tensions?
They were
Did you?
light-hearted, and people would say, "I don't like this," or "I don't like that," and so it'd get bumped off. And I think the funniest moment in when we were self-producing in the early days, we had a guy called Martin Birch who was very good. We put him down as producer, but really everyone was leaning over the control panel and with their hands on their own levers. And so somebody once said. The Deep Purple sound in the studio was basically everything has to be louder than everything else. That was the immature approach to it. We've refined things a bit now.
It worked, whatever you did.
Yeah.
What does a Deep Purple album still need to have for you to feel like it's Deep Purple?
Well, I think we got lost a bit in the Middle Ages. We were trying too hard, I think, and we just lost direction, I think, a little bit. Roger came up with a great phrase. We were having a little ding dong back and forth with Bob, as we always do in the studio. And Bob and Roger spoke up a wonderful phrase for the. He doesn't very often do this, but he just said, "Bob, we mean it." So I think when Deep Purple means it, then we've got a good album. I know it's a bit obscure, but that's how I look at it.
I'll take it. Do you have a favorite song?
There's a funny story about that. In a Japan interview, because an interpreter came in reading off a list of questions, because the journalist couldn't speak English. And one of the questions was, "What's your favorite album?" And I said, "Machine Head." And then she went out the door and came back in again as if she'd never been there and was reintroduced. And my name is so and so, blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't believe what I'm seeing or hearing. And so one of the questions was, "What's your favorite album?" And I said, "Fireball." And she just went to pieces and collapsed completely and eventually said, well, admitted she had been in the room earlier and said, "But you said for a different magazine that Machine Head was your favorite." I said, "That was over half an hour ago." Music is not one of those things like when you're kid, you have a favorite color, a favorite pet, favorite car, favorite film actor, favorite pop star, whatever. But I think, as you grow older, your favorite thing one day is not necessarily your favorite thing the next day. But
Right.
my favorite album at the moment is, of course, Splat, My second favorite is a live recording of an obscure band I had once called Repo Depot in Bucharest. It's up on my website. And it's utterly amazing. The first 4 minutes are chaos because there's no sound, but it reminds me of how things were. And my favorite song right now is one we do live on stage. It's called Lazy Sod. That's all about my sleek black cat and I that were in a, got a bit too relaxed one day at home. It's
Oh.
an interesting story. My sleek black cat, by the way, is a 90-pound puma, so likes to be called Kitty.
Kitty.
But of course,
Oh boy.
that's not really true. And I'd say I'm a truthful person, basically, but I do tell lies when I'm doing interviews.
That poor lady in Japan. Is that when you wrote Highway Star after that?
No, we were on Highway Star way before that. Yeah, that was
Oh.
we were on a bus going down to a show in Brighton in on the south coast of England, and we had some journalists on the bus riding with us. And one guy, I'm sitting face to face with Richie, and one guy says, "Well, how do you write a song?" And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, how are we going to answer that?" And Richie, ding, 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 ding. Oh, he's playing, he's rehearsing on his guitar. He just goes on an open string, ding, 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 ding. He said, like that. So we wrote it on the bus and we did it in the show that night.
Amazing.
It did get adapted over the years, but it was one of those moments.
What about Smoke on the Water?
We were doing a show in Montreux, which is a summer resort. So the last show of the season was in November or December, I can't remember. And it was Frank Zappa and the Mothers. And I was particularly keen to see it because they had Flo and Eddie from the Turtles doing vocals in the band. And so we went along and some guy shot a flare gun into the ceiling. It's a wooden building caught in the electrical trunking and the place caught on fire. Everyone rushed out and we had to move. And we ended up at the Grand Hotel. We spent a few days, limited time. We had the Rolling Stones mobile recording unit outside in a truck, and on the last day, as it started, our engineer said, "You're 7 minutes short of an album," and we were bereft of ideas. What were we going to do? So he said, "Well, that sound check we did at the beginning sounded pretty good. Maybe you can make something out of that." And it was labeled as the Dan Dan song, as in Dan 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 Dan. So we pulled it up and we wrote a biographical story of the making of the album in Montreux, as in we all came out to Montreux on the Lake Geneva shoreline, blah, blah, blah. So that became the song. Interestingly, after the album was released, it kind of got forgotten because it was 7 minutes long. It never got played on the radio or anything. And a guy called Rush Shaw from Warner Brothers came along to see us one day and saw the crowd reaction to Smoke and took a second look at it, went back, did an edit, cut it down to 3 minutes 20, and Bob's Your Uncle. It became the most played rock song ever in history on the radio.
Incredible.
We're still doing it in the show, so
What about Child in Time? I gotta ask about that. It's all over
that was
social
it.
media right now, which I find interesting. And the chemistry between you two, Richie and you, and your voice is this
Well,
instrument, and it's just amazing.
John Lord wrote that basically. We openly inspired by a song called Bombay Calling by a band called It's a Beautiful Day. And I think it was them. Forgive me if not. They nicked one of ours as well. And in turn, there was he was playing these chords one day and I just started singing and Sweet Child. In time, you'll see the line between good and bad. It's all about, we grew up in the Cold War and it's about, bullets flying around and bombs dropping and mutually assured destruction and all that kind of thing. It was a young man's song. And I did this, what has been described at the Covent Garden as tenor passaggio. See, a lot of everyone said, oh, he's screaming. But the director of the choir there said, well, you're not screaming, you're singing. That's like saying Pavarotti's shouting. But he had a category already, tenor. So he said, your category is tenor passaggio, which means going above tenor. And So it was all written in 5 minutes in the community center in Hanwell in Middlesex, just on the outside of London in 1969, or I think, yeah,
Did you always
thereabout.
know you wanted to sing?
Well, I grew up in a musical family. My granddad sang opera. My grandmother taught ballet. My uncle was a jazz pianist. He played boogie-woogie and stride. I was a boy soprano in the church choir. And then I started my first band at the age of 17.
Right.
And I was hugely inspired by the young Elvis Presley. And I just stopped a guy in the street one day. In fact, there's a song on the new album, Splat, about the circumstances. It's called My New Movie. And it's about somebody dreaming about making a movie, and they just stop someone in the street and say, "What are you doing on Wednesday? Let's do it." And it was pretty much that. And I asked this guy, his name was Andy, and I said, "Do you know anyone around here who plays guitar?" He said, "Well, I'm learning." I said, "Okay, rehearsal's my house Saturday morning." And about five guys turned up with, you may not call them guitars, but they had some strings. And we got thrown out of the house, of course, after a while for wrecking the furniture and jumping up and down. And I went to the youth club, and they let us use the storage room to rehearse. I said, "We got no money." He said, "Well, the payment will be a performance on Saturday for the youth club." So, holy moly. So we learned some songs. I think we repeated them about six times, and we did two shows, 2 weeks running, and then I got recruited into another band that had some equipment and a residency. So yeah, things picked up from there. I was 17. That was 1962.
What were you playing? Were you playing cover songs?
Oh yeah,
Elvis songs?
there were I got easy songs, three chords, Buddy Holly stuff, and that sort of thing.
Aww.
Elvis, I think there was an Elvis song in there somewhere.
Amazing.
That's
And
all
then
I
you met
learned.
Roger Glover, right? Episode six.
In 65, yeah.
65. Wow. How did the invitation to join Deep Purple come to be? And did you guys go together? You're a package deal, right?
Yeah. Well, the episode six had seen its best days. We'd been abroad a lot, and we'd always been chasing fashion and chasing hits. I think we had 12 or 13 singles released, and they were okay. They were good. It was primarily a harmony band.
Yes.
We weren't so strong instrumentally, but it was nearing the end, I think. And Purple were looking for a new singer and bass player after their first three records. I was a huge fan. I had their records. Richie only lived around the corner, and another friend, Mick Underwood, a drummer who worked with Richie in earlier days, recommended me. He was in Episode Six at the time, so he recommended me very unselfishly. And Roger came along with me. And we joined Deep Purple not just as a singer and a bass player, but as a nascent songwriting team. And we recorded Deep Purple in Rock. And we changed, and they changed. And it's that human chemistry thing.
Did you realize right at the time how special you all were together? Like, did you know right away or?
Yeah.
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 Wow.
Our first show was at the Speakeasy in London. And I just looked at Roger and went, "Oh, mate, this is it. This is it. This is what we've been looking for." It's
Amazing.
that moment, like in the Jersey Boys, when they're in the studio and they record "Sherry," and you hear "Sherry" for the first time after all the build up and the formation and friendships of the band, and the trouble and strife, and then getting arrested in the church because it sounded great in there when they sang at night. We
Yes.
did all those kind of things, and then there's that magic moment, when you realize everything has just fallen into place. It's fallen from the sky. You don't know how or why.
Yeah. Ooh. I have goosebumps. You came, you left a couple times. How did you know? Okay, this is it. It's been a while now.
Well, I was doing a show in Hammersmith in London with my band, Gillan, and our band had been through a fantastic time for a few years, but it was also nearing the end. There were some bad vibes going around, and it was time to stop and move on. And I went for an Indian meal after the show with a hero and friend of mine. His name is Rodney Marsh. He used to play football for my football team, Queen's Park Rangers, and Manchester City, and he also played for England. And we were having a curry and drinking a few pints of lager. And he said, "Yeah, the band's great." He said, "But they're not as good as Deep Purple, are they?" I
Ha
thought, "Yeah, you're probably right." So next morning, I called John Lord, said, "Have you ever thought about, getting back together again?" And he said, "I've been sitting by the phone for 6 years waiting for it to ring and somebody to say that." So a year later, it wasn't possible straight away. I joined Black Sabbath for a year, and then we got together and made Perfect Strangers, and that was 1984, 85.
Any singers of today you particularly like?
Oh, too many to list. Too many to
Yeah.
list. Most of them are my friends, and if I leave one out, they'll be angry.
I hear you.
So,
I don't have any either.
I know a lot of people over the years, and they're all friends, and they're all great. So I love them all. It's a marvelous business to be in, and the rock and roll world is, I think, is a good club.
Yeah.
We've all been through it, and everyone
There's
there that's still around has paid their dues many times over.
What does music do for people?
Well, you talked earlier about the Ritchie Blackmore thing. It's not just the music; it's the camaraderie, it's the atmosphere, the sense of belonging. I know what it was like in the early days with fans. I mean, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, and Black Sabbath, we all knew each other. We all got on great. We used to drink together in the speakeasy and various other places in those days. And yet the fans, encouraged, I must say, by the music journalists, divided into, I won't say bitter enemies, but very competitive factions that they were all sort of supporting one or the other of the three. And so they were divided, but we were not. You've got to think of the fans as much as anything else. But they come afterwards when the music's made and you've done your thing. Then you sit down and put your hands together and pray they like it.
Oh, they like it. Did you ever think you'd be doing it this long?
No, no, it didn't.
Well, I'm
No,
so
I didn't,
grateful
but
you are.
I do enjoy the moment, and I've always been an optimist. So I never plan things. I've stepped off the rock and roll highway quite a few times if I sense something interesting out there in the down a country lane or around a corner. I tend to take that route. So it's always interesting.
Do you do anything special to hone your voice, or have you ever exercised it or
I do as few
protected
interviews as possible.
That's a good one. That's my cue.
No, it's no, I don't. I think early days it was difficult when you're still learning and you're still experimenting. And also you go through phases. I mean, when I was a boy soprano, my voice was obviously very, very high. When I was a young man, in my late teens up to 30, I had a young man's voice. When I moved into my middle age, I lost a couple of semitones on the top end, but I gained so much in the middle in the way of tone that I thought it was a good bargain. And so I didn't look back since then. And since then, it's been settled. I think probably the key to most of it, all of this, is the word key, for the songs to be in the right key. If you're straining all the time, you're going to run into problems.
Yes.
But no, I mean, I'm working differently now. I've kind of taken a new approach in the last few years, and it
How
sounds
so?
much more energy. It's more energy. Well, I think the approach is different because of the different musicians you work with. See, it's determined by the key they like to play in, and you really have no choice in it because they present you with a track with an idea, a song idea that's already established in their key, and they're loath to change it. So you've got to find a tune in there some way, and sometimes you've got to work around a natural harmony and make that the tune. It doesn't always work. But nowadays, I find I can very happily get a much bigger range if I start at a lower point. I can actually use the melody, the natural melody within the construction. So I'm really happy at the moment.
We are too. Thank you for your beautiful gift. Thank you so much, Ian. What an
All right,
honor.
cheers.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv.